AL. PP for personal particulars. PP for the shorthand of any human life in which the service has a passing interest. PP for penance. PP for pain. Full name of sub-agent, Doris Carlotta Gamp. Date and place of birth, Leipzig, 21st, 10th, 29. Education, graduated Jena and Dresden Universities in political and social sciences. One sister, Lottie, elementary school teacher in Potsdam, unmarried. CV and other personal particulars, age 23, recruited as junior filing clerk, Stasi HQ, East Berlin. Access restricted to confidential and below. After 6 month probationary period, access raised to secret. Assigned Section J3, responsible for processing and evaluating reports from overseas stations. 1 year into employment, forms relationship with 41-year-old Lothar Quince, held to be a rising star of GDR Foreign Service. Pregnancy and civil marriage follow. 6 months into marriage, Quince, née Gamp, gives birth to a son, names him Gustav after father. Unknown to her husband, she has boy christened by 87-year-old retired Russian Orthodox priest and Starets, Holy Wanderer, a self-styled Rasputin attached to Red Army barracks in Karlshorst. How the supposed conversion to Russian Orthodoxy occurred is not otherwise known. To escape Quince's notice, Gamp told him she was visiting her sister in Potsdam and made the journey to Rasputin by bicycle with Gustav in the basket. 10th of June 1957, at the end of her 5th year of employment, again promoted, this time to assistant to Emmanuel Rapp, KGB-trained director of overseas operations. To retain Rapp's patronage, also obliged to provide him with sexual favors. When she complains of this to her husband, he tells her the wishes of a comrade of Rapp's importance should not be denied. She believes that this is an attitude shared by her Stasi colleagues. According to Tulip, they are aware of the affair and aware that it constitutes a gross infringement of Stasi discipline, but they also fear that, given the extent of Rapp's power, if they report it, they will suffer the consequences. Operational experience to date. On joining Stasi, attended indoctrination course for all junior staff. Unlike most of her colleagues, has good spoken and written Russian. Selected for additional training in conspiratorial methods, covert meetings, recruitment and deception. Also instructed in secret writing, carbon and fluids, clandestine photography, subminiature, microdot, surveillance, counter-surveillance, basic WT. Aptitude rated, good to excellent. As Emmanuel Rapp's PA and Golden Girl, Rapp's description, she regularly accompanies him to Prague, Budapest and Gdansk, where he attends KGB-organized intelligence conferences of East Bloc liaison services. Twice employed at such conferences as stenographer of record. Despite her antipathy to him, dreams of accompanying Rapp to Moscow to see Red Square at night. Concluding comments by case officer. H. Covert Berlin to H. Covert Marylebone, no doubt with the assistance of Stas de Jong. Subsource Tulip's relationship with this service is conducted exclusively through Mayflower. He is her medical doctor, handler, confidant, personal confessor, and best pal in that order. So what we've got is a one-dog girl enthralled to our head agent, and for my money, that's how things should stay. As you know, we recently supplied her with our own Minox built into the fastener of her shoulder bag and cassettes in the base of a talc tin. She's also, as of now, the proud possessor of a duplicate key and pet shaft for the wax lock on Rapp's safe. It is gratifying, therefore, that Mayflower reports that Tulip shows no disturbing signs of strain. To the contrary, he says her morale has never been higher. She appears to relish danger and his only concern is that she will become overconfident and take needless risks. For as long as the two of them are able to meet naturally in Berlin under medical cover, he is not greatly concerned. However, an entirely different operational problem arises when she is escorting Rapp to conferences outside the GDR. Since dead letter boxes are no answer to ad hoc requirements, can Covert consider putting a blind courier on standby to service Tulip at short notice in non-German bloc cities? I turn a page. My hand is steady. Under stress it always is. This is normal operational discourse between covert headquarters and Berlin. George Smiley to Alec Limas in Berlin, personal, handwritten note, copy to file. Alec, in anticipation of Emmanuel Rapp's forthcoming visit to Budapest, please arrange for the attached photograph of Peter Gwillem, who will be acting as our blind courier, to be shown to Subsource Tulip ASAP. Best, G. George Smiley to Peter Gwillem, handwritten note, copy to file. Peter, this will be your lady in Budapest. Study her well. Bon voyage, G. Say something, Nelson asked sharply, looking up from his book. Nothing, why? Must have been out on the street. When you're examining the features of an unknown woman for operational purposes, carnal thoughts are on hold. You're not looking for charm. You're wondering whether she'll be wearing her hair short or long, tinted under a hat or free, and what her face has to offer in the way of distinguishing features. Broad brow, high cheekbones, small or large eyes, whether they're round or naturally attenuated. After the face, you'll be looking at the shape and size of the body and trying to work out how it would look if she were wearing something more recognizable than the standard party trouser suit and clunky lace-up shoes. You're not looking for sex appeal, except insofar as it may draw the eye of an impressionable watcher. My sole concern at this stage was how the owner of this face and this body was going to perform opposite a blind courier on a hot summer's day in the closely watched streets of Budapest. And the short answer turned out to be immaculately. Skilled, deft, anonymous, purposeful. And I, as her blind courier, no less. A sunny day, a bustling street, two strangers. We advance on each other, are about to collide, I veer left, she right, there is a momentary entanglement, I grunt an apology, she ignores it and sweeps on. I am richer by two cassettes of microfilm. A second brush in Warsaw Old Town 4 weeks later, although more demanding, also passes off without mishap, as witness my handwritten report to George, copy to Alec. PG to H, covert Marylebone, copy to AL, Berlin. Subject, Subsource Tulip, Blind Treff. As on previous occasions, we achieved early mutual recognition. Interbody contact was undetectable and swift. I do not believe that even close surveillance could have caught the moment of transfer. It was clear that Tulip had been excellently briefed by Mayflower. My subsequent offload to H Station Warsaw presented no difficulties. PG. And Smiley's handwritten response. Deftly done again, Peter. Bravo. G.S. But maybe not quite as deftly as Smiley thinks, or quite as uneventfully as my handwritten minute was so keen to suggest. I am a French tourist from Brittany travelling with a Swiss tour group. My passport describes me as a company director, but questioned by my fellow travellers, I reveal myself to be a humble traveller in agricultural fertiliser. Together with my group, I am enjoying the sights of Warsaw's splendidly restored old town. A well-grown young woman in baggy jeans and tartan waistcoat is striding towards us. Her hair, last seen hidden by a beret, is today flowing free and auburn. With each step, it bounces in the sunshine. She wears a green neck scarf. No scarf means no handover. I am wearing a party cloth cap with a red star, bought at a street stall. Shove the cap in my pocket, no handover. The old town is milling with other tour groups. Ours is less manageable than our Polish guide would wish. Three or four of us are already lost to her, chatting among ourselves instead of being lectured about the city's miraculous rebirth after the Nazi bombing. A bronze statue has caught my eye. It has caught Tulip's too, because this is how our encounter has been choreographed. There will be no slowing down as we meet. Nonchalance is all. Just not too much of it. No eye contact, but nothing too studied about the way we ignore each other. Warsaw is a very wired town. Tourist attractions head the watch list. So what's this jaunty swinging of the hips she's doing suddenly? And what's with the light of explicit welcome in the big almond eyes? For a fleeting second, but less fleeting than I am prepared for, our right hands curl into each other, but instead of instantly parting, her fingers, having deposited their tiny contents, nestle in my palm and would have gone on nestling there for longer if I hadn't prized them free. Is she mad? Am I? And what's with that flash of welcoming smile I caught? Or am I deluding myself? We go our separate ways, she to her conference of Warsaw-packed espiocrats, I with my group to a cellar bar where the cultural secretary from the British Embassy and his wife happen to be regaling themselves at a corner table. I order a beer and adjourn to the men's lavatory. The cultural secretary, known to me in another life as a fellow trainee at Sarat, follows me. The offload is swift and wordless. I rejoin my group. But the flutter of Tulip's fingers hasn't gone away. And it hasn't gone away now, as I read Stas de Jong's hymn of praise to Subsource Tulip, brightest star of the Mayflower Network. Tulip has been made fully conscious that she is reporting to this service and that Mayflower is our unofficial assistant as well as her cutout. She has decided she loves England unconditionally. She is particularly impressed by the high quality of our tradecraft and singled out her most recent treff in Warsaw as an example of British excellence. Tulip's terms of resettlement on termination of work, whenever they should occur, will be £1,000 per month of service completed, plus a one-time ex gratia payment of £10,000, as approved by H. Covert, GS. But her greatest wish is that when the time comes, whenever that is, she and her son Gustav will become British citizens. Her own covert gifts are perhaps even more impressive. Her success in installing a sub-miniature camera in the base of the shower platform in the women's toilet in her corridor relieves her of the stress of taking it in and out of house 3 in her handbag. Her office-built pet shaft and key enable her to enter and leaves wrapped safe whenever the coast is clear and she feels inclined. Last Saturday she confided to Mayflower that her most recurrent dream was of one day marrying a beautiful Englishman. Something wrong then? Nelson demands, this time with intent. I've hit a rosette, I reply, which happens to be true. Bunny has brought a briefcase with him and wears a dark suit. He's come straight from a meeting at the Treasury, who, with or why, he doesn't say. Laura lounges in control's chair with her legs crossed. Bunny takes a bottle of warm Sancerre from his briefcase and pours us all a glass, then opens a packet of salted cashews, saying we're to help ourselves. Heavy going, Peter? He inquires genially. What do you expect? I reply in the aggrieved tone I have decided to adopt. Not exactly a happy walk down memory lane, is it? But helpful, I hope, not too stressful, revisiting old times and faces. I let this go. The interrogation begins, at first languidly. Can I ask you first about Remek, an unusually attractive character for an agent, I would have thought? Nod. And a doctor, a pretty good one. Nod again. So why do Mayflower reports of the day, as distributed to lucky Whitehall customers, describe the source as, and I quote, a well-placed official employed in the mid-levels of the East German Socialist Unity Party with regular access to highly classified Stasi material? Disinformation, I reply. Planted by? George, Control, Laken in Treasury. They all knew the Mayflower material was going to cause a stir the moment it hit the stands. The first thing customers would be asking was who's the source, so they cooked up a fictional source of equal weight. And your Tulip? What about Tulip? Too fast. I should have waited. Is he goading me? Why else is he giving me that knowing, mirthless smirk that makes me want to hit him? And why is Laura smirking too? Is she getting her own back after our misfired Greek dinner? Bunny is reading from something on his lap, and his subject is still Tulip. Subsource is a senior secretary in the Interior Ministry with access to the highest circles. Isn't that going it a bit? Going it how? Doesn't it give her a bit more, well, respectability than she deserves? I mean, what about promiscuous senior secretary, for starters. Office nympho might be a better fit if we're looking for some sort of equivalence in the real world. Or holy whore, perhaps, in deference to her religious preferences. He's watching me, waiting for my outburst of fury, indignation, denial. Somehow I manage to deny him the satisfaction. "Still, I suppose you know your tulip," he goes on. "You who service her so diligently." I did not service her, and she is not my tulip, I reply with measured deliberation. The entire time she was in the field, Tulip and I did not exchange a single word. Not one. Not in all our treffs. We brushed past. We never spoke. "So how come she knew your name?" he inquires with his most charming, boyish smile. "She did not know my bloody name. How the hell could she, when we never said so much as hello to each other?" "One of your names, put it that way," he persists, unruffled. Laura's cue. "Try Jean-Francois Gamay for size, Pete," she suggests, in the same jocular vein. "Partner in a French electronics company based in Metz, enjoying a package holiday beside the Black Sea with the Bulgarian state travel company. That's a bit more than hello." My outburst of merry laughter is unconfined, and so it should be, since it's the product of spontaneous and genuine relief. "Oh, for Christ's sake," I exclaim, joining in the fun. "That's not what I told Tulip. That's what I told Gustav." So here you are, Bunny and Laura, and I hope you're sitting comfortably for this cautionary tale about how the most secretive and best-laid plans can founder on a child's innocence. My work name is indeed Jean-Francois Gamay, and yes, I'm a member of a large, closely observed travel group enjoying low-cost sea and sun in a not very salubrious Bulgarian beach resort on the Black Sea. Across the bay from our dismal hotel sits the party workers' hostel, a brutalist hulk of Soviet-style concrete covered in communist flags, and we can hear its martial music booming at us over the water, punctuated with uplifting messages of peace and goodwill from a battery of loudspeakers. Somewhere within its walls, Tulip and her 5-year-old son Gustav are taking a workers' collective holiday, thanks to the influential connections of the odious Comrade Lothar, Tulip's husband, who has mysteriously overcome the Stasi's reluctance to allow its members to romp on foreign sands. She is accompanied by her sister Lottie, the schoolteacher from Potsdam. On the beach between 4 and 4:15, Tulip and I will undertake a brush pass, and this time it will include her son, Gustav. Lottie will be safely confined to the hostel, attending a workers' council. The initiative lies with the agent in the field, in this case Tulip. My job will be to respond to her creatively. And here she is now, coming towards me through the surf, clad in a Mother Hubbard beach robe with a rope shoulder bag. As she advances, she directs Gustav's eye to a seashell or precious stone for his bucket. She has the same skittish swing of the hips that I had refused to acknowledge in old Warsaw town, except that I'm careful not to mention her hips to Bunny and Laura, who are following my every light-hearted word with undisguised skepticism. Drawing closer, she forages in her rope shoulder bag. Other sun worshippers, other children, are splashing, sunbathing, eating sausage sandwiches and playing chess, and Tulip on stage is not beyond a smile or a word for this or that comrade. I don't know by what ruse she persuades Gustav to approach me or what she says to him that makes him laugh out loud and scamper towards me in a dare and thrust into my hand a chunk of blue, white and pink coconut fudge. But I know that I must be charming. I must express delight. I must pretend to eat some of the fudge. I must drop the rest in my pocket, sink into a crouch, discover magically in the surf the seashell that was already secreted in my hand, and offer it to Gustav as payment in return. To all of which, Tulip laughs gaily. Rather too gaily, but I don't tell Laura and Bunny that bit either. And beckons him, "Come back now, darling, and leave the nice comrade alone." but Gustav doesn't want to leave the nice comrade alone. Which is the whole point of my witty story to Bunny and Laura. Gustav, who's a sassy kid by anybody's standards, has gone way off script. He reckons he's cut a deal with the nice comrade, fudge for shell, and he needs to get to know his new trading partner socially and commercially. "What's your name?" he demands. "Jean-François, what's yours?" "Gustav. Jean-François who?" "Gamay." "And your age?" 128. "What's yours?" 5. "Where does the comrade come from?" "Metz, France. What about you?"
"Berlin, Democratic Germany. Would you like to hear a song?"
"Very much." So Gustav stands himself to attention in the surf and sticks his chest out and gives me the benefit of a school song thanking our beloved Soviet soldiers for shedding their blood for a socialist Germany. Meanwhile, his mother, who is standing behind him, coolly unfastens the girdle of her beach robe and, with her gaze fixed on me, displays her naked body in its undoubted glory before languidly retying the girdle and joining me in my lavish applause for her son's performance, then looks on like the proud mother she is as I shake Gustav's hand, take a smart pace back and, right fist raised, return his communist salute. But the glory of Tulip's naked body is also something I keep to myself, while I ponder a question that has been burning in me before I ever embarked on my amusing story. How the devil did you know that Tulip knew my name? 7. I don't know what particular variety of fugue swept over me as, released early from my labours, I stepped out of the gloom of the stables into the afternoon bustle of Bloomsbury and, on no impulse I was aware of, headed southwest towards Chelsea. Humiliation, certainly, frustration, bewilderment, no question, outrage at having my past dug up and thrown in my face, guilt, shame, apprehension, any amount. And all directed in a single blast of pain and incomprehension at George Smiley for making himself unfindable. Or was he? Was Bunny lying to me as I was lying to him, and was George not quite as unfindable as he protested? Had they already found him and wrung him dry, as if that were ever possible? If Millie McCraig knew the answer, and I suspect she did, she was also bound to silence by her own version of the Official Secrets Act, which laid down that, alive or dead, George Smiley was undiscussable. Approaching Bywater Street, once a quiet cul-de-sac for the not-so-well-off and now just another of London's millionaires' ghettos, I refused to acknowledge the wave of nostalgia sweeping over me, or make the obligatory mental note of parked cars, scan them for occupants, or run a careless eye over doors and windows of the houses opposite. When was the last occasion I'd come here? My memory stops at the night I circumvented George's little wiles with wooden wedges in the front door and lay in wait to whisk him off to Oliver Lakin's sprawling red castle in Ascot on the first leg of his anguished journey to his dear old friend Bill Hayden, arch-traitor and his wife's lover. But on this late, idle, autumnal afternoon, number 9 Bywater Street knows nothing and has seen nothing of these things. Blinds drawn, front garden overgrown with weeds, occupants gone away or dead. I climb the 4 steps to the front door, press the bell, hear no familiar ring, no footstep light or heavy, no George, blinking his pleasure as he polishes his spectacles on the inside lining of his tie. "Hello, Peter. You look as though you need a drink. Come on in." No Anne in a flurry, with only half her makeup on. "Just about to go out, Peter, darling. Kiss, kiss, but do come in and sort the world out with poor George." I return at military pace to the King's Road, hail a cab to Marylebone High Street, and have myself dropped opposite Daunt's bookshop, but in Smiley's day, Messrs. Francis Edwards, founded in 1910, where he whiled away many a happy lunch hour. I plunge into a maze of cobbled alleyways and mews cottages that once comprised the circus's outstation for covert operations, or, in the parlance, simply, Marylebone.
Unlike the stables, which was only ever a safe house dedicated to a single operation, Marylebone, with its three front doors, was a service to itself. Its own desk officers, ciphers, cipher clerks, couriers, and its own grey army of occasionals, never known to one another and drawn from all walks of life, who had only to hear the call to down tools and rally to the cause. So was it remotely conceivable that Covert still had its being here? In my fugue, I chose to believe it was. And does George Smiley still skulk behind its shuttered windows? In my fugue, I must have persuaded myself that he did. Of the 9 doorbells, only one worked. You had to be one of the faithful to know which. I press it. No response. I press 2 other buttons in the same doorway. I move to the next doorway and press all 3. A woman's voice screeches at me. She's not bloody here, Sammy. She's buggered off with Wally and the kid. You ring again, I'll call the law. I swear I will. Her advice sobers me. The next thing I know, I'm seated in the quiet of Devonshire Street, drinking elderflower cordial in a cafe full of medics in suits, murmuring head to head. I wait for my breathing to come down. As my head clears, so also does my sense of purpose. For the last couple of days and nights, despite every distraction, the image of Christoph, delinquent, criminal, clever son of Alec, brutally interrogating my Catherine on the doorstep of my house in Brittany, has remained with me. Never until that morning had I heard the ring of fear in Catherine's voice. Not fear for herself, fear for me. He was not agreeable, Pierre. Farouche. Big like a boxer. He asked, "Do you stay in a hotel in London? What is the address?" I say my Catherine because ever since the death of her father I have regarded her as my ward, and to hell with Bunny's insinuations to the contrary. I watched her grow from infancy. She watched my women come and go until none remained. When she appointed herself the village bad girl in defiance of her more beautiful sister, and slept with every man-jack she could lay her hands on, I paid no attention to the pompous representations of the village priest, who probably fancied her for himself. I am uneasy with children, but when Isabel was born, I was as happy for Catherine as she was. I never told her what I did for a living. She never told me who the father was. In all the village, I was the only one who didn't know or care. If she wishes it, one day the farmstead will be hers and Isabel will trot along beside her and perhaps there will be a younger man for Catherine and perhaps little Isabel will be willing to look him in the eye. Are we also lovers with all those years between us? Gradually, it seems we are. The arrangement was brokered by Isabel, who one summer's evening padded across the courtyard with her bedding and, never a glance at me, installed herself beneath the landing window and the floor outside my bedroom. My bed is large. The spare room is dark and cold. Mother and child could not be separated. It is my memory that Catherine and I slept innocently side by side for weeks on end before turning towards each other. But perhaps we didn't wait quite as long as I would like to think. Of one thing at least I was sure. I would have no problem recognizing my pursuer. Clearing out Alec's dismal bachelor pad in Holloway after his death, I had stumbled on a pocket-sized photo album with a pressed Edelweiss slipped under the cellophane cover. I was on the point of tossing it away when I realized I was holding in my hand a photographic record of Christoph's life from cradle to matriculation. The German subtitles in white ink under each snapshot had been added, I assumed, by his mother. What had impressed me was how the same locked expression that I remember from the football match in Dusseldorf had stuck with him all the way to the thick-set, scowling Alec lookalike in a Sunday suit, clutching a roll of parchment as if he was about to jam it in your face. And what does Christoph know of me, meanwhile? That I am in London burying a friend. That I am being a good Samaritan. I have no known address. I am not a club man. Not even a researcher of Christoph's vaunted equality will find me listed at the Travellers or the National Liberal Club. Not in Stasi records or anywhere else. My last known abode in the United Kingdom was a 2-room flat in Acton that I had inhabited under the name of Peterson. When I gave my landlord notice, I left no forwarding address. So where, after Brittany, might severe, persistent, impolite criminal Christoph, son of Alec, strong like a boxer, come looking for me? What would be the one place, the only place, where, if he is really lucky, he might, given a fair wind, just possibly run me to earth? Answer. Or the only answer that made any sense to me. My old services, Lubyanka by the Thames. Not the old, hard-to-find circus of his father, but its gruesome successor, the bastion I was about to reconnoitre. Vauxhall Bridge teems with homebound commuters. The river beneath it is fast-flowing and jam-packed with traffic. I am not a member of a Bulgarian tour group, but an Antipodean tourist who is doing the sights of London. Cowboy hat, khaki waistcoat with multiple pockets. For my first pass, I wore a flat cap and tartan scarf. For my second, an Arsenal supporter's woolly hat with pom-pom. Net cost for the entire wardrobe at Waterloo Station's flea market, £14. At Sarat, we called them silhouette changes. To every watcher, there are distractions to beware of. I used to warn my young trainees, things your eyes won't let go, like the pretty girl bravely sunbathing on the balcony, or the street preacher dressed as Jesus Christ. For me, this evening, it's a handkerchief-sized rectangle of lush green lawn entirely enclosed by spikes that my eyes refuse to let go. What is it? An outdoor punishment cell for circus miscreants? A secret pleasure garden for senior officers only? But how do they get in? Worse still, how do they get out? On a tiny pebble beach at the foot of the bastion's outer ramparts, an Asian family in coloured silks picnics amid Canada geese. A yellow amphibious craft lumbers up the ramp beside them and stammers to a halt. Nobody emerges. The time is coming up to 5:30. I'm remembering circus working hours, 10 till whenever for the anointed, 9:30 to 5:30 for the unwashed. A discreet exodus of junior staff is about to begin. I'm counting up likely exit points, which will be dispersed in order to be inconspicuous. When the bastion was first occupied by its present tenants, there were tales of secret tunnels under the river all the way to Whitehall. Well, the circus has dug a tunnel or two in its time, most of them under other people's territory, so why not a couple under your own? When I first presented myself to Bunny, I had been passed through a man door dwarfed by a pair of crash-proof iron gates with an Art Deco motif, but my guess was that the man door was visitors only. Of the three other exits I have spotted, the one that best suits my intuition is a pair of grey-painted doors set at the top of an inconspicuous flight of stone steps on the river side, giving access to the flow of pedestrians on the footpath. As I round the corner, the grey doors part and half a dozen men and women emerge, average age 25 to 30. An expression of determined anonymity joins them. The doors close, I suspect, electronically. They reopen. A second group descends. I am Christoph's quarry, and his pursuer. I am assuming he's doing what I have been doing this last half hour. Familiarizing himself with the target building, picking likely exits, biding his moment. I am acting on the assumption that Christoph is driven by the same sound operational instincts as his father, that he has thought his way through the probable actions of his quarry and laid his plans accordingly. If, as Catherine says, I have gone to London to bury a friend, and why should he doubt it, then it's a racing certainty that I will also have dropped in on my former employers to chew over the irksome historical lawsuit that Christoph and his newfound friend Karen Gold are bringing against the service and its named officers, of whom I am one. Another batch of men and women is descending the steps. As they reach the footpath, I tag along behind them. A grey-haired woman grants me a polite smile. She thinks she should recognize me. Pedestrians on the public footpath mingle with us. A sign says to Battersea Park. We approach an archway. I glance upwards and see the hatted figure of a large man in three-quarter-length dark overcoat standing on the bridge, scanning passers-by below. The spot he has chosen by chance or design gives him a grandstand view of three of the bastion's exits. Having profited from the same vantage point myself, I can confirm its tactical value. Owing to the downward turn of his head and of his hat, which is a black Homburg with high crown and shallow brim, his face is in shadow. But his boxer's bulk is not in doubt. Broad-shouldered, wide-backed, and a good 3 inches taller than I would have expected of Alec's son. But then I never met his mother. We're through the archway. Dark coat and black Homburg has left the bridge and joined the procession. For all his bulk, he's a quick mover. So was Alec. He's 20 yards behind me, Homburg bobbing from side to side. He's trying to keep sight of someone or something ahead of him, and I'm inclined to think it's me. Does he want me to spot him? Or am I being excessively surveillance-conscious, another sin I used to rail against? Joggers, cyclists, and boats whisk past. To my left, apartment blocks. At their base, glitzy pavement restaurants, cafes, fast food stalls. I'm using reflections. I'm slowing him down. I'm remembering my own pontifications to new entrants. It's you who sets the pace, not the person following you. Be idle. Be indecisive. Never run when you can saunter. The river hums with pleasure boats, ferry boats, skiffs, rowing boats, barges. On the bank, buskers make human statues, kids wave bubbles, fly toy drones. If you're not Christoph, you're a circus watcher. But the circus watchers, even in our worst days, were never this bad. At St. George's Wharf, I peel away to my right and make a show of examining the timetable. You will identify your pursuer by giving them choices. Will he hop onto the bus after you, or will he say to hell with the bus and walk on? If he walks on, maybe he's leaving you to someone else. But the Homburg and black overcoat is not leaving me to someone else. He wants me for himself. And he's hovering at a sausage stand, scrutinizing me in the fancy mirror behind the mustard and ketchup bottles. At the ticket machine for ferries heading east, a queue is forming. I join it, wait my turn, buy myself a ticket to Tower Bridge, single. My pursuer has decided not to buy himself a sausage. The ferry pulls alongside, the pier rocks, we let the passengers off first. My pursuer has crossed the path and is bending over the ticket machine. He gesticulates irritably, "Help me, someone." A raster in baggy cap shows him how it's done, cash, not credit card, and the face still in shadow under the Homburg. We are boarding. The top deck is packed with sightseers. The crowd is your friend, use it well. I use the crowd on the top deck and find myself a space of railing while I wait for my pursuer to do the same. Does he realize I'm conscious to him? Are we into mutual awareness? Has he, as my Sarat students would have said, clocked me clocking him? If he has, abort. Except I won't abort. The boat turns. A shaft of sunlight picks him out, but the face remains in shadow, even if in the left margin of my sight I see him casting one stealthy glance after another at me, as if he's afraid I'll make a dash for it or chuck myself overboard. Can you really be Christoph, son of Alec? Or are you some lawyer's bailiff sent to slap a writ on me? But if that's who you are, why stalk me? Why not barge up to me here and now, confront me? The boat swings again, and again the sunlight finds him. His head lifts. For the first time I see his face in profile. I have a feeling I ought to be amazed and delighted, but I'm neither. I feel no rush of kinship. I am aware only of a sense of impending reckoning. Christoph, son of Alec, with the same unblinking stare that I remember from the football stadium at Dusseldorf, and the same jutting Irish jaw. If Christoph was reading my intentions, I was also reading his. He hadn't identified himself to me because he was waiting to house me, as the watchers would have it, to find out where I was staying and, having done so, choose his time and place. My response must be to deny him the operational intelligence he was after and dictate my own terms, which should be a crowded spot with plenty of innocent bystanders. But Catherine's warnings, adding to my apprehensions, force me to consider the possibility of a violent man seeking redress for my perceived sins against his late father. It was with this contingency in mind that I recalled how, as a small boy, I had been marched round the Tower of London by my French mother, to her loud and embarrassing exclamations of horror at everything she saw, and I remembered in particular the great stairway on Tower Bridge. It was this stairway that now spoke to me. Not for its iconic attractions, but for my self-preservation. Sarat Nursery did not teach self-defense. It taught a variety of ways of killing, some silently, others less so, but self-defense did not feature large on the menu. What I knew for certain was that if it did come to a fight, I needed my opponent's weight above me and all the help that gravity could provide. He was a prison-trained brawler with 40 pounds of bone and muscle on me. I needed to use his weight against him, and I could think of no better place than a steep stairway with my aged self standing a few steps beneath him to speed him on his way. I had already taken a couple of useless precautions, transferred any small change I had to my right-hand jacket pocket for use as short-range grapeshot, and threaded the middle finger of my left hand round a key ring as an improvised knuckle duster. Nobody ever lost a fight by preparing for it, did they, son? No staff, they never did. We were queuing to disembark. Christoph was 12 feet behind me, his reflection in the glass door expressionless. Grey hair, Catherine had said. Now I saw why, a mass of it, bulging in all directions from beneath the Homburg, grey, wiry, and untamed like Alex. The central mass of it plaited into a pigtail that hung down the back of his black overcoat. Why had Catherine not mentioned the pigtail? Maybe he tucked it inside his coat. Maybe pigtails weren't uppermost in her mind. In laborious crocodile, we filed up a ramp. Tower Bridge was down. A green light beckoned pedestrians to cross. Reaching the opening to the great stairway, I turned and looked directly back at him. I was saying to him, if you want to talk, we do it here with people passing by. He too had stopped. But all I could see in his face and eyes was the football spectator's relentless stare. I took a dozen quick steps down the stairway, which was empty save for a couple of down and outs. I needed a midway point. I needed him to have a long way to fall once he'd gone past me because I didn't want him coming back. The stairway filled up. Two giggling girls scampered past hand in hand. A couple of monks in saffron were engaged in earnest philosophical discussion with a beggar. Christoph was standing at the top of the staircase, a hatted silhouette in an overcoat. Step by step, with studied care, he began to descend the staircase, arms half raised from his sides, feet wide, the wrestler's stalk. "You're too slow," I urged him. "Come on down at me. I need your momentum." But he had drawn to a halt a couple of stairs above me. And for the first time I heard his adult voice, which was German-American, and high-pitched, which somehow shocked me. "Hi, Peter. Hi, Pierre. It's me, Christoph. Alex, little boy, remember? Aren't you pleased to see me? Don't you want to shake my hand?" Releasing the small change in my pocket, I reached up my right hand to him. He grasped it and kept it long enough for me to feel his strength, despite the slithery dampness of the palm. "What can I do for you, Christoph?" I said. And for answer got one of Alex's caustic laughs and that bit of Irish he put into his voice when he was camping himself up. "Well, boyo, you can buy me a bloody drink for a start." The restaurant was on the first floor of a self-styled oldie townhouse with fake worm-eaten beams and a slanted view of the tower through mitered windows. The waitresses wore bonnets and pinafores, and we could have a table if we agreed to eat a full meal. Christoph sat with his huge body slumped in his chair and his Homburg hat pulled down over his eyes. The waitress brought beer, which is what he asked for. He took a sip, pulled a face, set it aside. Fingernails black and chipped. Rings on every finger of his left hand. On his right hand, just the two middle ones that count. The face, Alex, but with pouchy discontent where pain lines should have been. The same pugnacious jaw. In the brown eyes, when they bothered with you, the same flashes of buccaneering charm. "So what are you doing with yourself these days, Christoph?" I asked him. He thought for a while.
"These days? Yes. Well, I guess the short answer is this," he replied, giving me the big smile.
This being what exactly? I don't think I've got the whole story. But he shook his head as if to say it didn't matter, and only sat up straight when the waitress brought our steak and chips. Nice place you got over there in Brittany, he remarked, eating. How many hectares? 50-odd, why? Your own? What are we talking about, Christoph? Why did you come looking for me? He took another mouthful, tipped his head, and smiled at me to say I'd made a good point. Why I came looking for you? 30 years now I've been a fortune hunter. Traveled the whole world. I did diamonds, I did gold, I did dope. I did guns a little. I did jail. Too much. Did I find my fortune? Did I fuck? Then I come home to little old Europe and I find you. My gold mine. My dad's best friend. His best comrade. And what did you do to your best comrade? You got him killed. That's money, man. That's real money. I didn't get your father killed. Read the files, man. Read the Stasi files. They're dynamite. You and George Smiley killed my father. Smiley was the ringleader. You were like his number one gopher. You set my dad up and you killed him. Directly or indirectly, that's what you did. And you dragged Miss Elizabeth Gold into the game. It's all in the fucking files, man. This great wicked plot you dreamed up that backfired on you and killed everyone. You lied to my dad. You and your big George. You lied to my daddy and you sent him to his death. Deliberately. Ask the lawyers, you know what? Patriotism is dead, man. Patriotism is for babies. If this case goes international, patriotism as a justification will not fly. Patriotism in mitigation is officially fucked. Same as elites. Same as you guys, he added. And, about to take a refreshing pull of beer, changed his mind and rummaged in the pocket of his black coat, which he had continued to wear despite the heat. From a battered tin box, he poured a dab of white powder onto his wrist and, closing one nostril with his spare hand, snorted it in full view of any customer who cared to watch, and several did. So what are you doing here? I said. Saving your fucking life, man, he replied, and, reaching out with both hands, grasped my wrist in a gesture of true fealty. So here's the deal. Your dream ticket, okay? My personal offer to you. The best offer you'll ever get in your life. You're my friend, okay? If you say so. I had prized myself free of him, but he was still gazing dotingly at me. You have no other friend. There is no other deal on the table. This is a one-time offer without prejudice, non-negotiable. He picks up his tankard, drains it, and signals to the waitress for another. 1 million euros. To me personally. No third parties involved. 1 million euros on the day the lawyers drop the lawsuit, and you'll never hear from me again. No lawyers, no human rights, no bullshit. You just bought the whole package. Why are you looking at me? You got a problem? No problem, just that it seems cheap at the price. I had rather understood your lawyers had already refused that amount and more. You're not listening. I am offering you cut price. That's what I'm saying. I'm offering you cut price, one payment only to me, 1 million euros. And Liz Gold's daughter Karen, she's happy, I take it? Karen? Listen, I know that girl. All I have to do, I go to her, I sing to her the way I do, I talk about my soul, weep a bit maybe, I tell her I can't go through with this thing after all, it's all too painful to me, my dad's memory, let the dead sleep, I got all the words. Karen's sensitive, trust me. And when I don't exhibit the necessary signs of trust. Listen, I invented that fucking girl. She owes me. I did the work. I paid the people. I got the files. I went to her. I gave her the good news. I told her where to find her mother's grave. We go to the lawyers. Her lawyers. Pro bono. The worst. Where does she get them from? Like Amnesty, some civil rights organization. The pro bono lawyers go to your government, preach them a sermon. Your government denies all responsibility, makes a backdoor, your ears only, we never said this, without prejudice offer of £1 million sterling. 1 million. And that's a base price. It's negotiable. Personally, I wouldn't touch sterling today, but that's a side issue. And what do Karen's lawyers do? Preach another sermon. We don't want £1 million, they say. We're high-minded people. We want you to eat shit. And if you don't eat shit, we will take you to court. And if necessary, all the way to Strasbourg and the European Court of fucking Human Rights. Your government says, okay, £2 million, but her pro bono still won't play. They are like Karen. They are holy. They are pure.
A metallic crash causes every head in the restaurant to turn. Christoph's unwashed left hand with all its rings has landed palm down on the table in front of me. He's craning forward, his face raining sweat. A door marked staff only opens, a startled head appears, and at the sight of Christoph, vanishes. You're going to want my bank details, okay, man? Here they are. And you tell this to your government, man. €1 million on the day we withdraw, or we throw the fucking book at you. He lifted his hand to reveal a folded piece of lined paper and watched me thread it into my wallet. "Who's Tulip?" he demands in the same threatening tone. "I'm sorry?" Codename for Doris Gamp, Stasi woman, had a kid. He had not announced his departure. I was still insisting that Gamp, Tulip, was not a name to me. A brave waitress was scurrying over with the bill, but he was halfway down the stairs. By the time I reached the street, all I saw of him was his huge shadow in the back of a departing cab and his white hand flapping lazy goodbyes out of the window. I know I walked back to Dolphin Square. Somewhere along the way, I must have remembered the piece of lined paper with his account number and chucked it into a litter bin, but I would be hard-pressed to tell you which one. 8. The benign weather of yesterday had been driven off by a lateral rain that raked the streets of Pimlico like gunfire. Arriving late for my tryst at the stables, I found Bunny standing alone on the doorstep under an umbrella. "We rather wondered whether you'd done a runner," he said, doing his shy boy smile. "And if I had?" "Well, let's just say you wouldn't have got very far." Still smiling, he handed me a brown envelope marked "On Her Majesty's Service" in red. "Congratulations, you are courteously requested to appear before our masters. The All-Party Parliamentary Committee of Inquiry wants a word with you. Date to be announced." "And a word with you too, I imagine." "Marginally, but we're not the stars, are we?" A black Peugeot draws up. He climbs into the back. The Peugeot drives away. "Got our reading boots on, Pete?" Pepsi asks. She is already installed on her throne in the library. "Looks like we're in for a heavy day." She is referring to the thick, buff folder that lies waiting for me on the trestle table, my unpublished masterpiece, 40 pages of it. "I am proposing that you draft an official report on the affair, Peter," Smiley is saying to me. It's 3 in the morning. We're sitting head to head in the front parlor of a council house on an estate in the New Forest. "I see you as the ideal person for the job," he continues in the same deliberately impersonal tone. "A definitive report, please, overlong, rich in irrelevant detail, and sparing us the one piece of information that only you and I and 4 other people in the world, God willing, may ever know. Something that will satisfy the prurient appetites of joint steering and act as an obfuscation for the head office post-mortem," I use the word figuratively. "That is sure to be called for. To be drafted for my sole approval in the first instance, please, my eyes only. Will you do that? Are you able?" With Ilsa sitting at your elbow, naturally. Ilsa, star linguist of covert, prim, punctilious Ilsa, who has German, Czech, Serbo-Croat and Polish at her beautiful fingertips, who lives with her mother in Hampstead and plays the flute on Saturday evenings. Ilsa will sit at my elbow, correct my transcriptions of German recordings. We will smile together at my little errors, discuss a choice of word or phrase together, send out for our sandwiches together. We shall lean over the tape recorder together, accidentally butt heads, apologize together. And punctually at 5:30, Ilsa will go back home to her mother and her flute in Hampstead.
Defection and Exfiltration of Subsource Tulip. Draft report assembled by P. Gwillem, assistant to H. Covert, Marylebone, to Bill Hayden, H. Joint Steering, and Oliver Lakin, HM Treasury, for approval by H. Covert. First indications that Subsource Tulip might be at risk of exposure occurred in the course of a routine treff between Mayflower and his controller Limas, Paul, in West Berlin Safe House, K2, for Zahnenstrasse, on 16th of January at approximately 07:30 hours. Using his Friedrich Liebach identity, Mayflower had cycled across the sector border into West Berlin with the morning cavalry of East Berlin workmen. Following Mayflower's recruitment by this service, it was decided to reduce his visible trips to West Berlin to a minimum. Berlin Station therefore supplied him with the identity of Friedrich Liebach, construction worker resident in Lichtenberg, East Berlin, where by his own devices Mayflower obtained the use of a garden shed for his pushbike and workers' clothing. A lavish English breakfast, including fried egg, bacon and baked beans, cooked by Limas, has become traditional fare for these treffs, which take place at irregular intervals depending on operational need and Mayflower's professional commitments. As usual, proceedings opened with a routine debriefing and random items of network news. Subsource Daffodil has had a recurrence of illness, but insists on continuing to play his part, receiving and forwarding rare books, brochures, and personal mail. Subsource Violet's report on the Soviet military build-up on the Czech border was well received by Whitehall customers, Violet to be granted the bonus she is demanding. Subsource Petal has a new boyfriend. He is a 22-year-old Red Army corporal of signals, a cipher specialist from Minsk, recently attached to her unit. He is an obsessive stamp collector, and Petal has told him that her aging aunt, fictitious, has a collection of pre-revolutionary Russian stamps that she is tired of and may be willing to part with at a price. She intends that the price, negotiated in bed, will be a codebook. On advice from Limas, Mayflower has assured her that London will supply an appropriate stamp collection. Only now does the conversation turn to Subsource Tulip, verbatim. Limas. And on the Doris front, is she up or down? Mayflower. Paul, my friend, I don't know and I can't diagnose. With Doris, each day will be different. Limas. You're her lifeline, Carl. Mayflower. She has decided that her husband, Mr. Quince, is taking too much interest in her. Limas. High bloody time, in what way? Mayflower. He suspects her. She doesn't know what of. Asks her all the time where she's going, who she meets, where she's been. Watches her while she cooks, dresses, goes about her life. Limas. Maybe Doris has got herself a jealous husband, finally. Mayflower. She refutes it. She says Quince is jealous only of himself, his shining career and his ego. But with Doris, who knows? Limas. How about life in the office? Mayflower. She says Rapp dare not suspect her because his disciplinary transgressions do not allow him to. She says that if she were suspected by IS, she would already be sitting in a cage in the detention house down the road. Limas. IS. Mayflower. The Stasi's internal security section. She walks past their door every morning on her way to Rapp's suite. At midday of the same day, as a matter of routine, Limas instructed de Jong to revisit existing contingency plans for the exfiltration of Subsource Tulip. De Jong confirmed that escape papers and resources for an eastward exfiltration via Prague were current. Having waited for the evening shift of workmen, Mayflower cycled back into East Berlin. Pepsi is being a fidget, repeatedly coming down from her throne to prowl the room for no reason or stand behind me to peer over my shoulder. I am imagining Tulip in the same state of restlessness, now at home in Hohenschönhausen, now in her office next to Emanuel Raps in Stasi House No. 3 in the Magdalenenstrasse. The second intimation came in the form of a doctor-to-doctor call. With the assistance of the West Berlin police, an emergency contact system had been put in place. If Mayflower called the Klinikum, West Berlin, from the Charité, East Berlin, and demanded to speak to his notional colleague, Dr. Fleischmann, the call would be immediately rerouted to Berlin Station. At 0920 hours on the 21st of January, the following rerouted conversation between Mayflower and Limas took place under medical cover. Verbatim. Mayflower, calling from the Charité, East Berlin. Dr. Fleischmann? Limas, speaking. Mayflower, this is Dr. Riemek. You have a patient, Frau Lisa Sommer.